From Studio H3 and the Current Affairs World Headquarters, it's Current Affairs, your ears' greatest hour of politics and culture. Today on the program, the panel discusses whether the political is personal. Nathan waxes poetic about Wikipedia, and we all share something that is trending in the right direction. Our panel today, Current Affairs legal editor Oren Nimni.
Hello, everybody.
Current Affairs contributing editor Brianna Joy Gray.
Hi, friend.
Current Affairs amusements editor Lyda Gold.
Hi.
And the editor-in-chief himself, Nathan J. Robinson.
Hello, everybody.
I'm your host, Pete Davis. Let's begin with segment one, Practical Tactical. In the recurring segment, Practical Tactical, we discuss different tactics and strategies being used in the political fights of the late 2010s, and whether we think they are good, useful, moral, and/or effective. We all know that the personal is political, but this week on Practical Tactical, we discuss what happens when the political becomes personal. How much should we care about the personal lives and the personal demons of our allied politicians? When taking on our opponent politicians, should we laser in on their political actions, or should we incorporate their personal life into our critiques too? This week, the right is grappling with the question, do we care about Brett Kavanaugh's personal actions if politically he is very useful to us? But what if we on the left faced a similar problem? What if the next Ocasio-Cortez or Bernie had personal demons but was politically good? Panel, in terms of regulating our own side and taking on the other side, when the political gets personal, what is the practical, tactical thing to do?
Okay, let's clarify what we mean by demons. So if somebody stole a car when they were 17, I don't care. Like that, no, whatever. If somebody attempted to rape somebody when they were 17 and nothing ever happened to them about it, and as an adult they deny it, I think that's a problem. That's like more than a demon. So I think we judge people because, all right, if we have politicians that we like, we say, okay, we expect you to go forth and do the things that we ask you to do. But a whole bunch of people who get into politics do it because they are narcissists and because they're bad people and they like power. So you have to be very skeptical and very careful with people. And especially if they've abused people in the past, that's really the sign that they're not to be trusted. But not every sin is created equal. And again, like some like random pranks when they were a kid is one thing. Random abuse when they were a kid is not nothing.
Yeah. I think what Light is pointing to, and I think that she's really right on the money with this, is the idea that there are some behaviors that seem to indicate something about a personality trait. And there's also the possibility that even if a past behavior does indicate something about a personality trait, if in the intervening years over a course of time, they've demonstrated that they've learned, admitted to, accepted responsibility for, and moved past that personality trait, then it's fair to assume they no longer have it. So there's certain, you know, like in the law, there's like a range of prior bad acts that can be brought in as kind of character evidence. I haven't been a lawyer for a while, so all you other lawyers can correct me. But like the idea is if you commit certain kind of crimes that indicate that you're untrustworthy, right, then that could be brought in as evidence that you are lying, right? You can be impeached with that kind of evidence. And I feel some kind of way about the kinds of acts that are considered in that context. But I think the idea is right, that if what you did in the past suggests that you have like greater moral failings than just like being a kid going on a joyride, or the thing that you did in the past suggests that you don't have respect for another person's bodily autonomy, then I think that's a much bigger deal. It's fair to say that even if it's 35 years later or whatever, it still matters.
To me, I agree with the things that both of you are saying. To me, though, the thing that is important and the link between the personal and political is less about whether I would trust a politician based on a prior bad act, because I think we should start from a baseline of not trusting any politicians, but instead that their prior bad act actually also has a political implication rather than a personal implication. You know, for example, one thing that I think we believe on the left that our representatives should want and should advocate as a policy position is accountability, you know, meaningful accountability for prior acts. And so I think if you're someone that has done something previously and taken no accountability for it whatsoever, then that actually to me is a very political position, not just a personal position as well. Now, I do think that there is a separate question as to what we focus on when we're trying to challenge, for example, right-wing politicians. I think there's a couple of things to think about, and one of them is, you know, how attenuated the act is from the thing that we actually want to stop them from doing. Like, for example, with Brett Kavanaugh, the act that he did is awful. The reason that we don't want him to be confirmed, though, I think is more about his policies, or at least for me is more about his policies and the fact that he will hurt many, many other women by virtue of his decisions on the Supreme Court, than because we don't trust him or didn't think he was sufficiently held accountable for this particular act. And so I think that that opens up the possibility for a double standard. I think that's something we can get around. But I do think, you know, the left needs to be really good at articulating not just why something that seems really obviously bad is actually bad, even if the right wing doesn't understand that, but needs to be really good at articulating why all the policy things are also bad.
I agree.
Yeah, because with Kavanaugh, I have a big worry that he's going to be forced to withdraw his nomination, and then Trump is going to nominate someone else who is unblemished by this kind of
Amy Coney Barrett, for example.
Such as perhaps Amy Coney Barrett, who can overturn Roe versus Wade and is a woman, and then will place more legitimacy on it. At the same time, the personal thing really makes the case. Assuming Christine Blasey Ford is telling the truth, it's kind of open shut that he shouldn't be on the Supreme Court, not just because of the act itself, but because it would mean that he's lied to the Senate and the public, and that is, you know, trying to discredit someone who he once tried to rape. So it doesn't even matter that it was a long time ago, because those things are horrific. I think another complicated question that people always bring up is, though, when it happens on our side and we stand something to lose politically by holding people to a high standard personally. This was the debate about Al Franken was, well, but Al Franken is a good senator. He's a good ally for the Democratic. He's a great senator. We love him. We don't want to lose Al Franken over this. And it was that debate didn't necessarily last very long because Al Franken was in a blue state and was replaced with another Democrat. That debate, I think, would rage more if he was in a red state, in a vulnerable seat. And the question was, well, do we put up with this personal failing for the sake of, again, the consequentialist thing? We don't want to hurt people through bad policies.
The thing is, with our side, is this is part of a larger project of deepening our bench, because we should have such a deep bench of people that we're training to be politicians advocating our ideology that we do not rely on any given politician. You know, one of the great, just totally on the inverse side, one of the great problems of the Obama era is we were relying on this preternaturally unblemished person that will make up for, you know, us not having a bench by being specifically charismatic and specifically averse to like any personal blemishes. And if we had a super deep bench, we could just have very high standards for our politicians. Because one of the things that makes me so angry about this is they're like, oh, you know, should anyone who has had anything in their past be allowed to be on the Supreme Court? And I'm like, we have 300 million people in our country. I would like every member of the Supreme Court to be in the top 10,000 people in our country. And yeah. And I don't think Brett Kavanaugh is in the top 10,000 most amazing people of the 300 million. And that's exactly the biggest fact about him. He's just a Republican, you know, operative.
Exactly.
Actually, I would rather someone have done something bad and then been held accountable if they were going to be on the Supreme Court. I actually do not want people that have
former felons, only people who've gone.
I kind of do believe that because like one of the problems with the Supreme Court is that everyone thinks that they are completely infallible, and it would be nice if there was some sort of indication that, like, one, just sort of the concept of that all people are redeemable, but two, that the people that are deciding cases are more like everyone else who have done some good things, have done some bad things. And for the bad things, they have actually taken account and done something to transform.
You, You can't have been born in the U.S. to be on the Supreme Court. That's by the rule.
Yes, finally, I have a chance.
But the problem is that these guys do think that they're in the top of the top 10,000, but it's by the standard of having gone to one of two schools, and apparently one of a handful of prep schools. Because, oh my God, what kind of country do we live in where it turns out that two out of the nine would end up going to the same D.C. prep school? Like, what does that say about how we concentrate power and what the kind of feeder pipe is for the Supreme Court?
Yeah.
One great example of how to diversify people and also account for, you know, redemption that captures this well is Lee Carter, who is the socialist state rep in Virginia, had this amazing thread where he just admitted to all of his foibles before it came up. Yeah. And it's like a little bit political because he is running again and he is a politician already.
He did do some framing when he did that tweet.
Yeah.
And I don't know the details, and I don't want to like make a claim of knowing all the details, but something that is a very human thing that I wish we could have as part of this regimen, because we're saying like, oh, does anyone ever get out of Me Too jail? And I'm like, well, that would be a live question if someone actually apologized before Ronan Farrow found out about them. Mm-hmm.
Seriously, anybody can come forward at any time.
Yeah, and that's something that we've talked about a lot, and which Vanessa has written about for Current Affairs, which is this idea of a path to redemption, that there should be one that exists if we're good, you know, leftists who believe in rehabilitation for people who've committed all kinds of crimes. But I think what's really important that a lot of people here and elsewhere have pointed out is that, you know, admitting to what you've done wrong is a crucial part of that. And there are acts that are required before absolution that may include time passing, but aren't limited to just confession and then time passing.
I think if we're thinking about Brett Kavanaugh, for example, though, that we have to point out both that we believe in the personal and the political, right? Because like he could have done all the redemptive acts and we still wouldn't want him to sit on the Supreme Court.
Well, yes.
And I think that, you know, just to get back to it, that I don't think our not wanting him to sit on the Supreme Court has that much to do with his redemptive acts. That is another thing about him that's bad, but that wouldn't, you know, that would be necessary but not sufficient for him to be a Supreme Court justice. And there is this thing where, particularly with political jobs, that there is a reason to not give someone a position of power when they've abused power in the past. But also there are particular bad acts that one might have done before where you could imagine that the accountability for that would be different, where like taking account for that bad act would be one thing, and whether or not you should have the political position would be another thing if they didn't involve sort of the same abuse of power.
So getting back to the question of, you know, when do we forgive acts in our own, you know, in our own people, I think we have to be very, very careful not to play team sports. And I see people doing that a lot. And already, like, we have these a few lefty stars and everybody, you know, even when there's a teeny little thing that they say, there's already this temptation to circle around them and not call them to account for the things they say or for the things they may have done in their past. I think a really good standard to have is imagine that someone from the other team did something like that. So if, say, somebody maybe misled people about being a working class immigrant, if that person was a Republican or if they were a centrist Democrat, what would you say? Would you have the same reaction? And just because, you know, just because somebody does something that you don't like doesn't mean that they have to go or you won't vote for them or whatever, but you do have to call them to account and you do have to admit when people on your team have done things that are bad.
So, but this goes to the initial question that somebody raised, which is, you know, we're at the end of the day also balancing the interests of the communities these people are representing and whether or not holding them accountable as they should be held accountable means that their constituents are going to be put in a position where they're now being abused by whomever would replace them. And I struggle with that. I think you're right that in the Al Franken example or even the Bill Clinton example, there was very little to be lost. Bill Clinton would have been replaced by Al Gore. It would have been fine. Maybe Al Gore
would have run one re-election.
Yeah, like, you know. But at the same time, like I also think there's something that's a little bit naive about the way that sometimes our side talks about these issues as though there aren't electoral consequences. So like I wrote this piece in the spring that was basically looking at the brouhaha that had emerged over Louis Farrakhan and Tamika Mallory, who had planned the Women's March and was famous for that reason as a kind of resistance leader. It turns out is a big fan of his and had attended a bunch of his speeches or whatever and had like wished him happy birthday and all this stuff. And there were a lot of people who were mad at her, rightly so, because Louis Farrakhan is a noted anti-Semite. And I took that opportunity to explore the fact that there are a lot of people who support candidates and other public figures for mixed reasons. And to try to convey to people who don't really understand how people could have voted for Trump, that there are people who voted for Trump because he's racist. There are people who voted for Trump despite being racist. Neither of those things is good. But the latter, I think, is understandable to people who like also like Farrakhan for the things that he's done to support the Black community, despite the fact that he's been an anti-Semite.
So we take Keith Ellison, Elizabeth Warren, Julia Salazar, all three of which have now had scandals of three different kinds. Elizabeth Warren, the Native Heritage, Julia Salazar, the who Leiter was subtweeting a little bit there.
Was with the I?
Well, now this is another case of someone discussing it. And Keith Ellison, who has had abuse allegations, all of whom are favorites of the left, and all of whom there's now an instinct to rally around because the left has so few people on its bench, as Pete said. What do you do? Is it okay to set those things aside? Well, because we like those people?
This is sort of the thing that I was trying to get at. I don't think it's okay to set those things aside, but I think, like, let's take the Warren example for instance. I'm not tied to Warren. I don't actually particularly care if she's in office or not, but I do think that what she has done is something that can both have accountability while she stays in office. Like, I would be okay with accountability for these things not always looking like not getting your office. Not that I think anyone is due any of these particular offices. You could also just go and be a person in the world and not be a politician or a Supreme Court justice. But I think that at least for Warren and Salazar, it seems like there should be some kind of ability to be like, okay, I fucked up on this. You know, I admit that. Let me sort of deal with that and that'll be fine. You know, if the accusations against Keith Ellison are true, then I think that falls into a different category that, you know, we've sort of already said might be prohibitive of having that kind of power. But I think that there is some sort of middle ground.
So I think we have to balance two different impulses. And the one is that if somebody does anything that's slightly out of line, they're dead to us forever. And the other is these people are our heroes and we need them. Therefore, everything they do is fine and we'll pretend like whatever the thing is that they did didn't happen. So I think we have to arrive somewhere in the middle. And again, it does depend on the specific thing. I don't live in Julia Salazar's district, but I thought about it and I looked at the other guy and I was like, you know what? If I were in the district, I'd vote for her.
Right.
Because this other guy's corrupt as hell.
But is there a thing that she could have done which would have made you say it would have been better to have the other guy?
Yeah. Yeah. If she had abused somebody, that would have been the thing. That would have been the deal breaker. You know, there are deal breakers and it has to do with abuses of power and all that. But kind of lying about your identity a little bit, sort of, it's not great.
Is it being
so
great
in a world? Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to ask a question for is it, if Julia Salazar had abused someone, mm-hmm. would you not vote for her because that's an immoral thing to do and you just think that she's a bad person and therefore shouldn't get to be in office? Or would it be because that's an indication about something that you think, some sort of value that she has politically, and so you think that that might pop up again in the future and you know, she might end up doing something bad for, you know, as an abuse of power later on?
I think also it's about setting standards for who's okay to be on our side and who's not. And who, you know, gets the DSA label and the leftist label and who we're okay with. And we have to say at a certain point, like, we don't want people who are power hungry and are just there to, you know, exert power over the people. So we have to look for these warning signs and these red flags. And if occasionally that means losing a district, I mean, again, it depends on the district, depends how important it is, depends on what's going on.
And if it's president? Because that's just what Trump voters said. This is what the Republicans said. They said, at the end of the day, I want these Supreme Court picks. I feel very strongly that, you know, abortion is murder. We obviously disagree, but we have similarly strongly held convictions. If our guy, our woman, were Trump, had done the kind of things that Trump had done, but the alternative was to get Trump in office, right? Like, if Hillary Clinton basically had killed that guy they said she killed,
or like Trump, Trump, you know, raped his partner, raped her.
Sure,
partner.
Sure. Yeah. But she was running against, let's say, a John McCain type character, a typical Republican, not a terrible, not the worst of the worst, but who for sure was going to put a bunch of like anti-abortion folks in the Supreme Court and cut taxes and social services and all that. Would we still vote for Hillary Clinton Trump?
It's harder when it's on that scale. It's true. Yeah. I don't know if I have a good answer for it. It depends on the scale. And then the stakes are that high. It's a hard choice.
Yeah, it just comes back to this long-term project of we have to make sure if we're in this like trolley problem, political trolley problem at the end, you know, that means we failed early on in like recruiting candidates and having like a depth. Yeah. And it's just like we have to build a structure that doesn't rely on like any one person being this like philosophy point.
And I think make it clear that my politics include being a decent person because I'm trying to make the world a more decent place. So there's no, you can't separate your politics from your character very much because having good character is part of the thing that the left should be about, is being humane and decent. And
yes. Yes, yes, and like, look, my ideal vision is just that everyone is really decent and we have an Ella Baker style thing where it's like a leaderful movement and we don't have politicians and, you know, so it doesn't really matter what any one particular person has done. You know, they can be sort of put into leadership, put out of leadership, and we can have accountability. But that's sort of not the world that we live in. And I do wonder in this particular moment, like, yes, I want everyone to be nice, but the people that usually get political power, even if they have good policies, are people that have the amount of ambition that I don't think is good for the world. And that's sort of who ends up being the politicians in this moment. And so I do think that it's valuable to create a structure. You know, it's great to create like a better feeder. So we have a deeper bench and nicer people going in. But assuming that we have people that are politicians going in, you know, I do think we need to have some kind of standard in this moment of like, you know, how much weight we put behind the personal versus the political criticisms of the right, how much we hold our own politicians accountable, even if they pass good policies. You know, can you hold someone accountable and still give them a position of power? Like, all of those things, I think, are good questions for us to grapple with until we get the nice bag feeder.
Any final thoughts on this?
So I'm struck by the fact that it seems like after all of this, we're still in this limbo place where we've recognized that actions matter. We've said that there is a potential path to absolution. So the rhetoric that Republicans are using right now that says, you know, what does this mean? None of us can ever do anything because we've all had youthful indiscretions. / rape. But we also are saying that like we want there to be certain standards for our people and that we should draw like some sharp lines in the sand and say there's certain kind of behaviors we won't accept. At the same time, we all recognize that there's sometimes political realities that mean that perhaps for the greater good, we should vote for people who we don't respect. Perhaps is a way to resolve this to say, if we were presented with our version of Trump, would we be able to say he's or she is terrible, but we're going to vote for them anyway? Because I have found that like Republicans will at least admit that Trump is terrible, but they're doing it for the Supreme Court or they're doing it for some policy that they find. It's hard for me to support them because their ideals are so like not rooted in ethics, but like some ethical principle that really matters to them. Like, does that make a difference or does that almost make it worse?
No, I like that as a rule. It's like a signing statement by a culture. You know, it's like the reason you have concurrences in judicial decisions is you say, I'm going to vote for this, but I want the future to know and the public to know that I'm doing it for a different reason. And that might be healthier for the culture than pretending to just be on Team Blue and be super excited and downplay all the downsides.
I think that's, you know, it might, but I think that that's true and might be the best pragmatic thing to do. And at least signals that something is wrong. But if someone knows that they can do something bad, and then they can just get power, and all we'll say is like, well, I didn't want to vote for you, but I did anyway. Like, I don't think that that provides much of an incentive. I mean, I do still think that for me, the Brett Kavanaugh thing is providing like a weird lens on this, because I really, really do think that just what he would bring to the court is so terrible that the left is almost taking an easy out, even though... you know, even though what he did is terrible when he was younger, the left is kind of taking an easy out. And I'm worried about the left boiling down all of its critiques to personal critiques. And this is what we saw a little bit with Trump, where it was like, oh, you know, he's vulgar. Oh, he's uncouth. Rather than like, you know, he's going to drone bomb this many people. He's going to deport this many people. And I mean, I think we need to have both in front of us, but that the policy considerations, just because of the amount of people that they hurt, need to weigh very strongly. And we need to always keep those there, even if we also have personal critiques.
I agree with that. And I think that perhaps the idea would be to say, I'm going to vote for this person, this candidate. I'm going to go ahead and cast my ballot and hold my nose, but know that this person is going to get a challenge from the party at the next possible opportunity. And I'm going to keep the pressure on this person and let them know that we haven't, like, we've only, this is like a temporary detente.
Mm-hmm. Which I guess is kind of what we do with, I mean, well, it's not really what we do right now, but it's what we could do even if they're bad on policy. Like, could have voted for Hillary Clinton, held your nose, and then been like, we're going to challenge you next time.
Yeah, but the party, on some level, the party has to do it too. Because like, you and I, like everyone on this podcast would have that attitude about Hillary Clinton, but it feels a little weak if the party establishment, the way the Republican establishment has rallied behind Trump, isn't going to support, is going to support the incumbent no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
They're better at politics because they're worst people.
I think that's true, probably.
It's a problem we have with Republicans. They're really good at this because they don't care.
Well, until we win socialism.
Yes.
Then.
What a wonderful note to end on, Oren. we got to go to break, but we'll be back with segment two, Wax Poetic. This episode is sponsored by the Current Affairs Radio Archive. Anyone who stops by the listening room at the Current Affairs World Headquarters can browse clips from throughout the program's 85-year run. In this clip from 1944, we hear a bit from Season 5 of Red Rose, the flagship production of the short-lived Current Affairs Radio Theater.
Presenting the rip-roaring radical exploits of Red Rose, the globe-trotting socialist adventuress. When we last left our heroine, she was swimming in a scuba suit toward a secret underwater Nazi base. Accompanied, as always, by the ever-faithful and patient Lucy.
Oh, Red! What you gotten us into this time?
Quickly! The sluice gate is closing!
That's the brave and beautiful Marianne! French resistance fighter. Last week, she approached Red Rose in a tavern moments after five Vichy officers lost their top secret papers and their trousers in a poker game with our clever card shark.
Red Rose, you must help me. La Résistance needs you.
Why, hello, Marianne. Do you still need me?
Oh, Red, we do not have time for this now. There are U-boats leaving from the base at Saint-Nazaire, loaded with supplies. Where are they going? They do not resurface. We think the Nazis are building something. Something secret and terrible.
After their long scuba suit journey, our heroines have made it through the sluice gate and into the secret Nazi base.
Red, this is the last time we go swimming off just because one of your girlfriends...
What is this? The air is water, but we can breathe. So strange. Oh, but it is hard to walk.
Lean on me, Marianne.
Eye on the ball, Red. Eye on the ball. Or in this case, the giant octopus.
An octopus propels toward them, wearing a Nazi armband and brandishing a different weapon in each terrifying tentacle.
Lucy, toss me that trident.
There, you frightened him off. It looks like he was guarding something.
This big door.
Beyond, it looks like a city. Could it be...
Is it really?
The lost city of Atlantis.
Nah, not a rat's chance.
Correct, Red Rose. This is not Atlantis. I am Dr. Steckter-Wissenschlafter, head of the Atlantic Research Division. We came down to this ocean floor many years ago looking for Atlantis, the original Homo the Aryan race. We searched and searched and, well, somehow we never found it, but...
Gee, what a shocker.
It doesn't matter. Nothing matters. So what if we are losing the war on the surface? We'll build a new Atlantis here, under the sea. This Atlantis will be the once and future home of the once and future Reich!
Wait, they really think they came from Atlantis?
Almost like the Nazis ain't just monsters. They're also gullible morons.
Silence! I will not hear you disparage the Reich.
What Reich? All I see are jellyfish. And one octopus that's totally flipped its wig.
This is all very serious. My Atlantis will be treated with respect. Squids, get them!
Tune in next week for the exciting conclusion to this rip-roaring radical exploit of Red Rose, the globe-trotting socialist adventuress.
Hear more at the Current Affairs Radio Archive. We're back with segment two, Wax Poetic. The internet is filled with negative rants. Current Affairs knows all too well that a good takedown tends to travel far and wide on Twitter and Facebook. But in the recurring segment, Wax Poetic, we try to turn the tables and see if a positive rant can have the same effect. Today's positive ranter, our own Nathan J. Robinson, here to share with us his love for Wikipedia. Nathan, take it away.
Okay, so Wikipedia, it's so good that I don't think we realize how good it is. Or we maybe once appreciated how good it is, but now we just are so used to it that we've forgotten just what an incredible and what a different website Wikipedia is. So Wikipedia, you know, 5 million articles, 18 billion page views a month. Everybody uses it. It's all over the world. It's in hundreds of languages. It's one of the top websites anywhere in most of the countries that it's in. And it's the early criticisms of Wikipedia that was unreliable have just fallen away because Wikipedia is clearly not just reliable generally, but more reliable than any other encyclopedia. It has no competitors as an encyclopedia now. But the thing that is truly amazing about Wikipedia is that it's the most socialist thing on the internet, and it's succeeded. It has demonstrated a model of governance online that is present nowhere else. It's not like Facebook, it's not like Twitter, it's not for profit. They have given up just an extraordinary amount of potential advertising revenue to keep this thing non-profit, number one, but not just non-profit, but completely user-controlled. Wikipedia, the rules, even the rules, are written by the users. Everything is open to revision by the users. Now, Wikipedia is very clear about saying that it's not a democracy because it doesn't open things up to just majority vote, but it uses a consensus participatory process where everyone can join, anyone can participate, there's no profit motive in this thing whatsoever, and it's all these people volunteering and coming together without any financial incentive to create a repository of all the knowledge in the world. And it's all public domain, it's all of Wikimedia Commons has millions of images that anyone can download and recycle and use. And so I think it shows us first that participatory decision-making processes can work. It shows us that people do things for non-financial incentives. In fact, the incentives that they do have are kind of interesting because they give each other, like, little social rewards. Like, there are these things called barn stars that you could give people. Like, you could give people one of them is the ray of sunshine, which you can display on someone who, whenever you see them, it makes you know that all is right with the world. You can give them the resist hive think award for those who question consensus, the good friend award for people who help new and inexperienced people. There's one for people who have learned from mistakes they've made. There's one for people who have been mistreated. If you're mistreated, they'll give you a little star to make up for it. It has this incredible, and the rules, they have this thing called WikiKit, which is their Wikipedia etiquette, and it's founded on Wikilove. And, I mean, it's almost sickening in its sappiness. The first rule of Wikipedia is respect other Wikipedians, resolve through things through consensus, compliment before you criticize. And they've built this culture, and it works. It just works. It's gotten better, and now it's amazing. And I think it shows us that socialism will work.
Can we wiki a new constitution?
It sounds so lovely. It's like they're all nice. What?
Can I give Orin the Ray of Sunshine Award?
Oh,
in perpetuity.
Oh. Current Affairs, the Resist Hive Thing Award.
First,
I want the star for all the abuse I'm receiving online.
Yeah, you can have, yeah, you can have a mistreatment award. Stars.
I'm a constellation.
I love that description of Wikipedia. To me, it sort of is like. So one of the questions you always get if you tell someone that you like are an anarchist is they're like, well, who's going to take out the trash? And the Wikipedia is sort of like, well, the person that wrote the article on trash collectors would probably be the person that would be into taking out the trash. So I that was really lovely. Nice rant, Nathan.
What?
I'll live tweet it right now so that
one like civic popular. Engineering thing that's interesting about Wikipedia is, you know, one of the critiques when you say I love democracy is that people assume that democracy is basically we vote on everything from a centralized body about everything. And what's great about Wikipedia, some people have described it as an ad-hocracy, which is the reality of like deep democracy, is that democracy is a bunch of layers and overlapping areas and overlapping things where different people have different levels of power or interest or buy-in or skin in the game. And it's not just like everyone meets up for a giant legislature. And so Wikipedia just has these different ad hoc circles of people that are empowered to do specific things, and then other ad hoc circles that are empowered to like watch over those ad hoc circles, and then for the biggest decisions that are foundational, they have like more serious, you know, decision making processes.
They have a Supreme Court, right? They have an arbitration committee where when things can't be resolved among the editors, they go to the arbitration committee, but that court is elected by the editors and is accountable to the editors, and there are processes that try and do everything they can to keep things from getting to the point where they have to be resolved by them.
So I love that this is a nice rant, and I don't want to make any criticisms because I want it to get all popular, but I do have a question. So the thing that's always troubled me, the one possible troubling thing about Wikipedia has been brought up by the right, hence the creation of Conservapedia, which as noted, we are not on yet. But
fake news.
There is the danger, one might say, that Wikipedia could become biased sort of internally and not know it, and that is actually exacerbated by the fact that some very small percentage of Wikipedia users and editors actually edits like some massive percentage, like 95% of the articles are edited by a very, very small subset of people. And I can't recognize if that's had any effect, you know, and I don't think it would be recognizable to me, but there is that kind of danger that the people that have the most time or the most buy-in or whatever are going to be controlling this in a way that it's not completely user-generated.
I'll bring a very stark fact into this. 90% of Wikimedia project contributors in 2018 are men.
Yeah. Whoa. So there's that. Like, what do you do about that? I mean, that sucks.
I'll add to that point to say that I have noticed that when I go to Google, like what I consider to be very popular Black R&B artists from like the 60s and 70s and 80s, I will notice they have very short or no wiki presence at all. Mm-hmm. And I am confounded by this. People who I think are like Elvis to me don't exist on Wikipedia.
When I look up mythology, there is a lot for Greek mythology and Western mythology, and not a ton for, let's say, Hindu gods.
But I think this is not a criticism of Wikipedia's process. I think this is a criticism of mostly of society, which is to say that Wikipedia is edited by people who have a lot of free time. and who have disproportionate amounts of comfort. And so it's going to reflect the demographics, particularly of those of the people who are able to edit Wikipedia. And so, yeah, that absolutely there are biases that are pretty obvious in the encyclopedia.
I do wonder
entries.
If that's a thing that. I do wonder if that's a thing that Wikipedia could work to fix, though, because, like, yeah. So one of the main critiques in, like, baseline anarchist consensus process is that the people that end up talking and controlling the process the most reflect power relations yeah. in society, so that yeah. even if you have a completely open democratic consensus process, yeah. white men end up talking the most. Yeah. And so the fix for that is sort of, you know, a preferential kind of stack in consensus process where you give preferential selection to people who are not white men so that they have more speaking yeah. ability and more power. And I mean, I feel like Wikipedia could do that.
Well, it's a little harder because everyone's anonymous and they're committed to the principle of anonymity.
Right.
I think one of the major reasons for it is that people are unpaid. It's all volunteers. Mm-hmm. And so anyone who can't do large amounts of unpaid labor simply can't be. And there's also the one thing they could work and fix, and they are sort of trying to work to fix, is lowering the barriers to entry. So it used to be that you had to learn a lot of stuff to really be a Wikipedia entry editor, about the culture of Wikipedia editors and how things were done. And they're introducing easier editing processes so that people who are not that versed in this kind of cult, there's a little bit of a culty aspect to the culture, and you don't necessarily have to know that much about it in order to participate.
Yeah, the lack of payment is kind of troubling, especially if we're thinking of it as a socialist model. Sorry, not to you know, throw cold water on things, because it is all this labor that people are doing and they're not getting paid for it. And again, as we said, it's only the people who can afford to do unpaid labor all day and care about that.
The good thing is there's no profit.
Right. Right. But there's still, it's still unpaid labor. Mm-hmm. And so if we lived in a society with, let's say, a UBI, and anybody who wanted to could just earn their UBI and post on Wikipedia all day, that'd be great. But I mean, it's great as a basic model, but we have all these larger problems that have to be solved.
The problem is that, like all systems, it exists in a society that already has its hierarchies and biases mm-hmm. and disparities and problems. But just like, it's the same thing with all the attacks that come to the so-called universal programs, right? Like, mm-hmm. yes, if we don't work to make sure that they're equal, they can be corrupted by the fact that society is corrupt. But that's not a good reason not to do it. That's a good reason to keep paying attention to the fact that society is corrupt and trying to fix it and trying to have systems in place that balance things and make things more equal, which is why we should have mandatory voting.
Oh, whoa.
She went there.
You just dropped that in. Agreed. Again. I don't know that that's where that led us.
No, we should have, like, if everybody were doing Wikipedia, if, like, everybody had to, like, serve a time doing Wikipedia the way you have to serve on a jury.
I don't want to.
Maybe
hang out with those nerds.
But one of the things that seems nice about Wikipedia is that, like,
you're too mean for Wikipedia, Lyda.
I am way too mean.
Well, we can have Meanapedia.
They kick me out.
But one of the things that does seem nice about Wikipedia, maybe not on a structural level, but just on a, like, a feel-good level, is that it is this, like, wonderful voluntary association, and that, you know, I want people, you know, I don't like the bias that emerges, but I want people that sort of decide, like, this is a thing that I really care about, and so I'm going to put a lot of time and effort into it. I was going to ask a question to you, Nathan, about, since it seems like you've learned a lot about Wikipedia recently, how do they... Is it just completely user generated? Like, do they say, like, oh, here are things that topics need to be done on, or is there that sort of prompting, or is it just like it's
yeah,
like
but it's decided among the editors, right? Editors flag articles that need additional work on them, and then people come in and try and fix
stubs.
Them.
There are campaigns within it. So, for example, on this page about gender bias in Wikipedia, they have a campaign about increasing the amount of women in history pages that are being done. And then they'll, like, create a badge for that and create a group internally that will, like, try to create it. And they created 17,000 new articles in one of their campaigns on just increasing one thing. So you could start a campaign called Lost Jazz Artists and, like, slowly try to Wikipedia all of them.
Well, and one... That's the other thing. You know, you can fix if you see these major deficits. They can be fixed, which is one nice thing. Current Affairs, for example, has a Wikipedia entry. I didn't make it. Someone made it who likes Current Affairs. It's changed a little bit because as we got a podcast, it was added to the article. But it's still a stub. We only have a stub, but it says on our stub.
Hint, listeners.
This American Political Magazine article is a stub. You can help Wikipedia by expanding it. It also contains a lie, our Wikipedia entry, because it says we're based in Washington, D.C. and London instead of New Orleans. But that lie reflects a lie on our website.
I wonder who perpetrated that lie.
That lie only exists because I thought it would be.
Can I share my absolute favorite critique of Wikipedia? And oh, Nathan, you go first.
Can I say one more thing first, which is just on this bias question, I think it is better than the available alternatives when we think about Facebook and Twitter. There, the model of how content is going to appear and what content is going to appear is decided by Mark Zuckerberg and Jack.
At Jack, right?
And so it is way better than that, those models. And the nice thing is that it's transparent, which means that its bias is out in the open. You can go to the page and you can see the entire history of the editing of the page. It's not like Facebook and Twitter where the algorithms are secret and nobody knows how they decide what shows up. You can tell why things are on Wikipedia and who added what. And I think if Facebook and Twitter operated on the Wikipedia model, you'd still see biases, but they still wouldn't be ruled over by a single white male dictator in the way that... And you could see that from Jimmy Wales, right, who founded Wikipedia and has also been subjected to it by having his own Wikipedia entry edited to include various criticisms of him.
And it's also different than other encyclopedias as well, if that's the that's the other sort of comparable thing, is Twitter and Facebook, and then also other encyclopedias, which are massively biased just by the publishers and the writers.
I have to end on my favorite critique of Wikipedia, which also might be my favorite critique ever, because it's such a strange critique. It might have recently been beat by a recent article in like a library science journal that accused Little Free Libraries of being like a rightist conspiracy.
They're neoliberalism.
Yeah, our neoliberalism.
They're
neoliberalism
because they represent the privatization of access to books.
Yeah.
No, they represent nice things. They're nice.
Equally attacking a totally nonprofit thing that just seems like a delightful voluntary organization. The theorist Jaron Lanier, do y'all know Jaron Lanier? He occasionally writes these anti-tech manifestos. He wrote You Are Not a Gadget. He just wrote 10 Reasons to Quit Your Social Media. And he's a techno dystopian. And he wrote a famous article within some tech circles called Digital Maoism, The Hazards of the New Online Collectivism, where he attacks Wikipedia as digitally Maoist. And his reasoning is that Wikipedia ruined the culture of people having homepages about specific pieces of information. So if you wanted to learn about a certain type of frog, you would have to go to like Mark's frog page, and it would have weird pictures of the frog, and you'd have to click through all of Mark's link about the frog. Or if you wanted to learn about the Rolling Stone, you'd have to go to this weird GeoCities website about the Rolling Stones, and Wikipedia forced them all into a Maoist format that made them all boring and black and white and without the like star backgrounds and the weird web trees. And so that's the strongest and most passionate critique I've ever heard of Wikipedia.
Wow.
Wow, I forgot the Ray of Sunshine Award, part of Maoism. That
yeah.
Part of Maoist 5-year plan.
Reading a Wikipedia entry is like reading the Bible closely. There are faint traces of the voices of various anonymous authors and editors, though it is impossible to be sure, said Jaron Lanier, because he liked when the information was given to you by one random person as opposed to like,
I don't know, people seem to like the Bible. So...
Any final thoughts on Wikipedia?
Well, Pete, before we end, could you also share with us that fun Jimmy Wales fact?
Jimmy Wales is so weird.
He's a weirdo.
Very weird.
I like that he's a libertarian, though. A self-identified libertarian that created this socialist project.
Yeah. He named his daughter after an Ayn Rand character. He's all there.
Yeah. He's very odd. But it makes me think that, like, there, you know, it's heartwarming
to someone that like likes some of the parts of libertarianism in the when they can be combined with socialism. I'm like, oh yeah, I don't know why you like Ayn Rand, but this is nice.
In 1996, before founding Wikipedia, Jimmy Wales co-founded Bomis, a search engine that came with a Bomis Babe report, a blog with photos of scantily clad celebrities and porn stars. And he has objected to a Wikipedia page entry that said Bomis peddled porn, quote, saying the mature audience portion of the business is significantly less than 10% of total revenues. So he's really denying.
That's not saying you didn't do it.
Yep.
And so right after the Bomis Babe report didn't work out, he founded a compendium of all the world's knowledge. So people can change.
Pivot. It was the pivot.
Hey, babes are part of knowledge. No, who's hot and who's not? That's part of what we're about.
Coming soon from Current Affairs.
On that note, Lido, we have to go to break.
Good night, Musk. In the Fremont dusk, there's a factory and a sad Elon Musk and a whole bunch of badly made cars turning to rust. And there were three little fires coming from tires and two little tweets and a pair of receipts from the SEC's files on the upcoming trial. And no workers, no fanboys, no bowl of good kush, just the very last board members whispering hush. Good night, dusk. Good night, Musk. Good night, workers striking against Musk. Good night, Grimes, and good night, crimes. Good night, fires, and good night, tires. Good night, tweets, and good night, receipts. Good night, files, and good night, trial. Good night, cars, and good night, Mars. Hello, bars. Good night, Kush. And the very last board members whispering hush. Good night, stars. Good night, air. And good night, billionaires everywhere.
We're back with our final segment of the night, Good News Bears. In the recurring segment, Good News Bears, we share good news. This week's topic, positive trend lines. We are going to go around and each share our favorite statistic, phenomenon, wave, and the like that is trending in the right direction. Who wants to go first?
I can go.
Lida.
I'm really excited about mine. Oh my God. Okay. I've been reading a lot about carbon capture and specifically something called direct air capture. And it's this idea that you can suck the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and then inject it into the earth and store it that way. And it sounds kind of crazy, but it actually does work. So there's a couple of different ways to do it, and one of them involves sort of injecting into sandstone, which is a little bit, there's a risk of leakage. You would not want a big carbon burp to come up someday. But I was reading about this super cool thing they figured out in Iceland. They injected carbon into the volcanic basaltic rock there, and it forms crystals. It combines with iron and other things, and it forms crystals. It actually turns into rock. So you're sneaking carbon out of the air, and you're injecting it into the earth, and it becomes rock. So that's cool as hell. Anyway, the reason this is so exciting is it is one big problem we have with climate change is even if we go carbon neutral as fast as we can, we've already done a ton of damage. And if a bunch of cascading effects happen, if the permafrost melts, that kind of thing, we're in a lot of trouble regardless. So I feel like this has given a lot of people people deny it. I think one of the reasons people deny climate change is because it's scary. And when scientists are saying, well, we're all going to die, it's like, well, I might as well live my life. And what difference does it make? So it's really good to know that there are ways that we can mitigate what's happening. The bad part about carbon capture, there's two bad parts. One is that it's expensive. The other is that Koch brothers and ExxonMobil are behind it. And the reason they're behind it is they think that if they get behind this kind of this carbon capture stuff and in a small way, then they can keep polluting everywhere. And that's not going to work. We have to immediately stop polluting and use this stuff. But it's still, what is actually good about that is they put money into it, and that is slowly making it less expensive and making it more scalable. So if we can combine it with, let's say, what was just released today by the People's Policy Project, which was a proposal for a carbon tax, And the carbon tax would be, you know, a big tax on polluters, which would make it not profitable for them to be polluters. And plus, the savings from that, the what that tax would go to, it would be a, what did Matt Brennan call it on the last thing?
A dividend?
Yes, it would go to a dividend that would go out to everyone. So it would like a $2,000 a month dividend for everyone. So that's pretty cool. And universal wealth fund, that's what I was trying to say. That would be pretty cool if we could make that happen. But we have to have this sort of two-pronged approach, which is one, stop polluting right now, and also work on carbon capture. Oh, and another carbon capture thing I forgot to mention is that forests work really well, too. So it doesn't just have to be technology. It's all kinds of things you can use. Kelp forests really help.
Wow. Good news bears, Lyta.
Right? We're not all going to die, maybe.
Anyone want to build on that?
Positive. Okay.
With their own good news bears. Thank you, Bree.
Last week, Barack Obama came around to this cool new thing.
Ooh. What is it?
Called Medicare for All.
Never heard of it. What is it?
He said single-payer healthcare is a good idea at a speech he was giving at the University of Illinois, I believe.
What a visionary.
And I'm really excited about how mainstream this new cool idea is becoming. And moreover, I'm obviously excited that in conjunction with that, I think it's 70% of Americans also support single-payer healthcare, including a majority of Republicans, a slim majority, but a majority nonetheless, and some like 84% of Democrats. So this gives me a lot of hope and positivity, despite the fact that when I went on MSNBC to talk about this last week, they threw up a stat from January, which showed that only 54% instead of 70% of Americans supported Medicare for All, and then went on to opine about how this isn't really tested and the people don't really know what they're voting for. But this is a positive segment, so I'm not going to go there. The point is that this is good news. And I just also want to say that I'm happy about the increasing extent to which people, normal people, voters are recognizing the importance of candidates that don't take money, that don't take corporate PAC money. And you're seeing a lot of enthusiasm on the ground for those candidates. And therefore, candidates are responding and understanding that, like, by not taking corporate PAC money, they can actually distinguish themselves from a PAC. And I like the fact that, like, not taking corporate money has become this litmus test that people well outside of the progressive movement have begun to adopt or led the way, frankly, in adopting. And it's frankly, like, awesome.
Bree, to what degree are we allowed to grumble that someone like Obama has spent so many years standing in the way of single-payer healthcare and now treats it as a brand new policy proposal?
It's something that I wrestle with because, like, honestly, obviously, I am happy if he's able to spread the message. And when I was on MSNBC, I was trying to be careful not to be too snarky about it because, like, I don't want to alienate people who love Obama. I understand why people love Obama. He is very likable and I like him too and was crying on election day and all that jazz. But, like, between us, yeah, it's irritating as heck.
But here's the I think, like, to put it really simply, Barack Obama sets the agenda for the Democratic Party, pretty much. As you can see, yeah, with, like, the Edward Snowden switch, you know, being excited about leakers when Bush is president, and then when Obama doesn't like him, being against leakers. So it's a tool that, you know, is useful to get a solid, you know, lock on a policy for
maybe
a group of people.
We can add, like, a 10-minute grumble drop and then go,
I will do my good news bears next, which is similar, which is I was reading Fear by Bob Woodward, and I was reading about the briefing that Steve Bannon gave to Trump right after the Access Hollywood tape came out, and every single person in his life was telling him to drop out. Bannon sits Trump down and he goes, "We're gonna make this super simple. You are going to talk about three things in the rest of this campaign for the next 3 weeks. You're going to talk about Wall Street, you're going to talk about illegal immigration, and you're going to talk about war and how we don't need any more unnecessary wars." And that third part is what I'd like to talk about, which is that just got me thinking, wait, that's like, that was a Republican telling the Republican to run against war, basically. And that's not the hopeful thing, because who knows if Trump's actually against war. But the hopeful thing is I was just thinking back on how bad
life was for someone who cared about the project of, you know, the peace movement in 2002 and how dark it was, like that there was no op-ed that would say that, like, this Bush era, you know, 24 watching war on terror machine was bad. And there was no newspaper that could question it. And there was no politician that was ready to fight it. And I know we're not there yet, but, you know, you look around at the ecosystem of information now, and I think the ecosystem is trending in the right direction, because I think, you know, the fact that The Intercept exists and there's a, you know, reporters going on MSNBC from The Intercept, which is mostly just completely devoted to being against imperialism. It's not a fringe publication. It's like a mainstream publication. The fact that there would be op-eds in The Washington Post and there would be young journalists that would be against this and would not get in line. And so I think we're nowhere close to where we were in the 60s. We're nowhere close to where we were in the, like, 1910s in terms of the peace movement, but we're much better than where we were in 2002. And I feel like it's trending in the right direction.
It's good. I like that, Pete.
I like that. Thanks, love all Steve of this. Bannon. I like that we're doing multiple hopeful, you know, like a nice rant and like good news bears. It's really nice. Well, I was going to do the same one as Nathan, but I'll switch mine around and do a different one. So here in Massachusetts, we just had a primary election season not that long ago. And one of the exciting races was there were a bunch of different progressive candidates running for district attorney in Suffolk County, the county that includes Boston. And the general sense was that none of those progressive politicians were going to win because they were all going to fight against each other. And what was going to happen was the conservative white guy was going to win and hold that office for the next 100 years like the previous one. That did not happen. Rachel Rollins, who is a candidate that has come out against prosecuting people for a whole host of low-level crimes, so much so that the police are now in conflict with her, saying, well, if you're not going to prosecute, we're still going to arrest people for the crimes. And so there's like this little war between the DA and the police. The fact that she won, and that this is also sort of still the era where Larry Krasner's office is really encouraging, and there have been a bunch of progressive DA candidates running, is really encouraging to me. I normally, and, you know, when it's not good news bears time, we'll still say, well, you know, fuck DAs, and they're still putting people in prison, and all of that. But as far as like a just a like a pragmatic thing, I think that this is really encouraging that there are a bunch of different progressive DAs running in counties across the United States that are advancing positions that are not just like, oh, we're going to stop things a little bit, but they're like, we will not prosecute this whole host of crimes. We will like consider all of these different factors. We will actually think about restorative justice rather than pure punishment. And I think that as an ideological shift, that's great. And then also just as a concrete shift of how many people we're going to put in jails, that's also really excellent. And so I'm encouraged by that as part of the trend in the criminal justice movement, which I think is moving in a pretty good direction. You know, a bunch of bond funds and bail funds have popped up. The movement to close Rikers and close Cook County Jail has been new life has been breathed into those movements. You know, so I think even though there's still a bunch to fight against and for-profit prisons are, you know, have more of a share of the prisons now than they used to, and there's all these other sorts of things, those DA races in particular have been really encouraging.
Right on. In fact, I'm currently editing a piece that should come out tomorrow morning about this woman, Andrea Harrington, who won the district attorney's race in Berkshire County against this moderate incumbent, is what I'm trying to say. But she was announced today that the guy she beat by like only about 600 votes has decided to do a write-in campaign, and there's no opposition, so it's like literally just the same race over again, minus the third person. So that's one to watch.
Hopefully people will go out and turn out and vote.
Yeah,
progressive DA versus the police would be like an amazing TV show. We asked that question a couple episodes ago. That would rule.
I'm excited for it. It's like it's gonna be a pitched battle because in the end I think she holds the bigger stick, which is, okay, you want to do something to challenge me? I'm going to prosecute you guys for every civil rights violation. Like, let's see how it goes. You want to, like, play chicken? I will.
Yeah, what's so dark is that, like, my boyfriend will say, like, at the Bronx PD, there's, like, a list of cops. Like, there's a literal list of cops that are, like, these are the ones we know are like, good for us because they have so many violations against them that, like this is a good case for us because no one will ever believe this cop.
Yeah.
You know? Like a list of people who can't testify, basically, because they're so easily impeached. Like, that's bonkers. Those people shouldn't be employed. That list should be taken to HR, and all those people should be given leave.
No, but then all the cases would fail. We need those cops.
Well, it'd be better if they weren't running around abusing people in the first instance.
Nathan, bring us home with your final good news bears.
So I have two. First is, I have been very critical of Harvard psychologist Steven Pinker and his awful new book, Enlightenment Now, where he argues everything is amazing. Things are getting better. The Enlightenment cured all of... Well, that's a little bit of caricature. But also, he points to...
we would never caricature Steven Pinker.
No, not us. He points to a lot of statistics about the world that are getting better. The elimination of most mass starvation, reduction of HIV infections. These things are actually positive things. There are trend lines that are moving in the right direction. And my main problem with him is actually not that he's wrong. It's just, it's like the Big Lebowski line. You're not wrong. You're just an asshole. He's wrong a lot, but the main problem is that he just presents these things in a way that suggests, well, the left doesn't pay attention to the fact that we've actually made a lot of progress. We have made a lot of progress. And in fact, we closed the hole in the ozone layer, which is good. People don't notice. This is actually a major environmental victory.
Wait, that happened?
Is that...
Yeah.
The whole of the ozone layer is kind of sorted out, if you look it up. Not quite, but the banning of chlorofluorocarbons actually was very successful. This is a small movement in the right direction that shows that we can reverse some of the damage, as Lida suggested. If we have massive state involvement and international agreement, it is possible to make some progress.
Oh.
So there are a number of trend lines that are moving in the right direction. But I want to just finish with one kind of closer to us here at Current Affairs, which is, first, the statistics on how many young people are now socialists are amazing.
Woo!
Which is like most of them.
Nathan nice. Is now going to announce the trend lines on Patreon subscribers.
Trend line on Current Affairs Patreon is amazing. So... thank you all for that. But actually, what I wanted to point to was an email that we got here from a man who wrote in named Isaac David, who is a 17-year-old. He's a 17-year-old high school senior. And he says, "Dear Current Affairs podcast staff, I am a 17-year-old high school senior and an OWL supporter on Patreon. I just listened to the bonus episode Nathan and Sparky did on education. I'm new to your magazine and the libertarian socialist movement in a whole. And you might be thinking, of course you are, but you're 17. But I'm actually really new to it. I discovered it about 3 weeks ago. I've been drawn to Nathan's writing. I actually followed the advice to go see Sorry to Bother You. Illegally, I might add, as I was still 16 at the time.
We should bleep that out so he doesn't get
in trouble. All right. That's, I said his name. I thought it was an excellent movie. And then he talks a lot about our review of education and what we said about the school system and Brian Kaplan's book about the libertarian perspective. And he said, I shared the same reactions. At first, I was horrified by the libertarians, but then I started thinking and it's become clear to me that students are the products of schools rather than consumers. And he has a really thoughtful email to us laying out his views on education. He says, I love your magazine and your podcast. I applied to college right now, and I've been thinking about what I can do and what's important to me. And he asks us for some advice. And he just says, keep up the good fight. Best wishes to you. And then he asks us if it's okay to share a Patreon link with a friend of his, even who doesn't actually pay for the OWL subscription. But it's one of the most thoughtful, lovely
you
emails.
You may share it, Isaac.
This kid is... Hi, Isaac. Isaac David. is 17 years old, and he's super, super smart, and he's only just come to find out about libertarian socialism and about us, but he's already thinking about it really thoughtfully, and you know, I don't want to give Isaac too much individual credit, because I don't think Isaac is alone, necessarily. He's one of a number of people who are young, and when I've gone to speak on college campuses, I've seen these people who are just super, super smart and thoughtful, and I don't think this kind of group of people who were thinking about these things existed when I was in high school. And so Isaac, the existence of Isaac David and many more people like him really gives me encouragement at the moment.
Yay! Yeah.
That is Isaac, ray of sunshine. All of these are very encouraging. Feels so much better now.
Yeah, I do too.
Oh man, what a wonderful note to end episode 11 on. Let's do our sound off. Light a gold.
Bye.
Orin Nimney.
Good night, everyone.
Brianna Joy Gray.
Bye-bye.
Nathan J. Robinson.
Good night.
I'm Pete Davis. Good night, everyone. And especially you, Isaac. Let's do footnotes. Many Democrats are still mad about Al Franken resigning. Senator Joe Manchin said, quote, "What they did to Al was atrocious." Bill Maher wants Franken to come out of retirement to debate Donald Trump. And the writer Michael Tomasky compared Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, who called for Franken's resignation, to the Queen of Hearts screaming, "Off with their heads." If Kavanaugh is confirmed, 22% of the Supreme Court will have attended Georgetown Prep. And despite only 9% of Americans attending private high school, 4 out of 5 of the conservatives on the court will have attended private high schools. Ella Baker was an influential activist in the civil rights movement who was famous for her critiques of the sexism, classism, and professionalized charismatic leadership model within the movement. When asked about her role, she responded, quote, "You didn't see me on television. You didn't see news stories about me. The kind of role that I tried to play was to pick up pieces or put together pieces out of which I hoped organization might come. My theory is strong people don't need strong leaders." In 2015, the lawyer Alice Backer founded the organization Afro Crowd to rectify Wikipedia's lack of articles about Black history and Black culture. They host edit-a-thons and talks across Metro New York. Find out more at afrocrowd.org. This month is not the first time Barack Obama has expressed support for single-payer healthcare. In 2003, Obama was videotaped at an AFL-CIO event stating, quote,
"I happen to be a proponent of single-payer universal health care plan,"
unquote. By 2004, however, he began stating that a single-payer plan was not feasible. The popular belief that young lefties get more conservative as they grow older is generally a myth. A 2014 study out of Columbia University found that, quote, "The political events of a voter's teenage and early adult years, centered around the age of 18, are enormously important in the formation of these long-term partisan preferences," unquote. Put another way, the meme wars have long-term consequences. Thank you to Dan Thorne for editing help on this episode. Thank you to Lyta Gold for our delightful bits. If you like what you hear, listeners, consider becoming a patron at our Patreon page, patreon.com/currentaffairs. Also, consider subscribing to the print edition of Current Affairs. Learn more at currentaffairs.org. Remember that Current Affairs is a two-way street. Leave us a message at 504-867-8851. That's 504-867-8851 with an idea, a critique, a question, whatever you want. And we might play it on the air. Our theme song is "The Gherkin Train" by Joe Smith and the Spicy Pickles. This has been Current Affairs.